Welcome to The Great Stories. I'm Trev Downey, and each week I'll read and then discuss a truly great short story by one of the iconic authors. Who doesn't enjoy being told a tale? Humans have been telling each other yarns as long as language itself has existed. Stories to entertain, to inspire, to frighten, and to teach. On this podcast, there will be no academic elitism. We will focus only on the story you'll be told, the context in which it appeared, and the author responsible for its creation. The Great Stories, you see, is for everyone. So, gather round, and let's enjoy this episode's tale. The Monkey's Paw by William Wymark Jacobs. Be careful what you wish for. You may receive it. Anonymous. Part 1. Without, the night was cold and wet. But in the small parlour of Laburnum Villa, the blinds were drawn and the fire burned brightly. Father and son were at chess. The former, who possessed ideas about the game involving radical changes, putting his king into such sharp and unnecessary perils that it even provoked comment from the white-haired old lady knitting placidly by the fire. "Hark at the wind," said Mr. White, who, having seen a fatal mistake after it was too late, was amiably desirous of preventing his son from seeing it. "I'm listening," said the latter, grimly surveying the board as he stretched out his hand. "Check." "I should hardly think that he'd come tonight," said his father, with his hand poised over the board. "Mate," replied the son. "That's the worst of living so far out," bawled Mr. White, with sudden and unlooked-for violence. "Of all the beastly, slushy, out-of-the-way places to live in, this is the worst. Pathways a bog and the roads a torrent. I don't know what people are thinking about. I suppose because only two houses on the road are let, they think it doesn't matter." "Never mind, dear," said his wife soothingly. "Perhaps you'll win the next one." Mr. White looked up sharply, just in time to intercept a knowing glance between mother and son. The words died away on his lips, and he hid a guilty grin in his thin grey beard. "There he is," said Herbert White, as the gate banged too loudly, and heavy footsteps came toward the door. The old man rose with hospitable haste, and, opening the door, was heard condoling with the new arrival. The new arrival also condoled with himself, so that Mrs. White said, "Tut, tut," and coughed gently as her husband entered the room, followed by a tall, burly man, beady of eye and rubicund of visage. "Sergeant Major Morris," he said, introducing him. The sergeant major shook hands and, taking the proffered seat beside the fire, watched contentedly while his host got out whiskey and tumblers and stood a small copper kettle on the fire. At the third glass, his eyes got brighter and he began to talk, the little family circle regarding with eager interest this visitor from distant parts, as he squared his broad shoulders in the chair and spoke of strange scenes and doughty deeds, of wars and plagues, and strange peoples. 21 years of it," said Mr. White, nodding at his wife and son. "When he went away, he was a slip of a youth in the warehouse. Now look at him." "He don't look to have taken much harm," said Mrs. White politely. "I'd like to go to India myself," said the old man, "just to look around a bit, you know." "Better where you are," said the sergeant major, shaking his head. He put down the empty glass and, sighing softly, shook it again. "I should like to see those old temples and fakirs and jugglers," said the old man. "What was that you started telling me the other day about the monkey's paw or something, Morris?"
"Nothing," said the soldier hastily. "Leastways, nothing worth hearing."
"Monkey's paw?" said Mrs. White curiously.
"Well, it's just a bit of what you might call magic, perhaps," said the sergeant major offhandedly.
His three listeners leaned forward eagerly. The visitor absent-mindedly put his empty glass to his lips and then set it down again.
His host filled it for him. To look at, said the sergeant major, fumbling in his pocket. It's just an ordinary little paw, dried to a mummy. He took out something out of his pocket and proffered it. Mrs. White drew back with a grimace, but her son, taking it, examined it curiously. And what is there special about it? Inquired Mr. White, as he took it from his son and, having examined it, placed it upon the table. It had a spell put on it by an old fakir, said the sergeant major. A very holy man. He wanted to show that fate ruled people's lives, and that those who interfered with it did so to their sorrow. He put a spell on it so that three separate men could each have three wishes from it. His manner was so impressive that his hearers were conscious that their light laughter jarred somewhat. Well, why don't you have three, sir? Said Herbert White cleverly. The soldier regarded him in the way that middle age is wont to regard presumptuous youth. I have, he said quietly, and his blotchy face whitened. And did you really have the three wishes granted? Asked Mrs. White. I did, said the sergeant major, and his glass tapped against his strong teeth. And has anybody else wished? Inquired the old lady. The first man had his three wishes, yes, was the reply. I don't know what the first two were, but the third was for death. That's how I got the paw. His tones were so grave that a hush fell upon the group. If you've had your three wishes, it's no good to you now then, Morris, the old man said at last. What do you keep it for? The soldier shook his head. Fancy, I suppose, he said slowly. I did have some idea of selling it, but I don't think I will. It has caused enough mischief already. Besides, people won't buy. They think it's a fairy tale, some of them, and those who do think anything of it want to try it first and pay me afterward. If you could have another three wishes, said the old man, eyeing him keenly, would you have them? I don't know, said the other. I don't know. He took the paw, and dangling it between his front finger and thumb, suddenly threw it upon the fire. White, with a slight cry, stooped down and snatched it off. Better let it burn, said the soldier solemnly. If you don't want it, Morris, said the old man, give it to me. I won't, said his friend doggedly. I threw it on the fire. If you keep it, don't blame me for what happens. Pitch it on the fire again, like a sensible man. The other shook his head and examined his new possession closely. How do you do it? He inquired. Hold it up in your right hand and wish aloud, said the sergeant major. But I warn you of the consequences.
Sounds like the Arabian Nights, said Mrs. White, as she rose and began to set up the supper. Don't you think you might wish for four pairs of hands for me?
Her husband drew the talisman from his pocket, and then all three burst into laughter as the sergeant major, with a look of alarm on his face, caught him by the arm. If you must wish, he said gruffly, wish for something sensible. Mr. White dropped it back into his pocket and, placing chairs, motioned his friend to the table. In the business of the supper, the talisman was partly forgotten, and afterward the three sat listening in an enthralled fashion to a second installment of the soldier's adventures in India. If the tale about the monkey's paw is not more truthful than those he has been telling us, said Herbert, as the door closed behind their guest, just in time for him to catch the last train, we shan't make much out of it.
Did you give him anything for it, father? Inquired Mrs. White, regarding her husband closely.
A trifle, said he, colouring slightly. He didn't want it, but I made him take it. And he pressed me again to throw it away.
Likely, said Herbert with pretended horror.
Why, we're going to be rich and famous and happy. Wish to be an emperor, father, to begin with. Then you can't be bossed around. He darted round the table, pursued by the maligned Mrs. White, armed with an antimacassar. Mr. White took the paw from his pocket and eyed it dubiously.
I don't know what to wish for, and that's a fact, he said slowly.
It seems to me I've got all I want.
If you only cleared the house, you'd be quite happy, wouldn't you? Said Herbert, with his hand on his shoulder.
Well, wish for £200 then. That'll just do it.
His father, smiling shamefacedly at his own credulity, held up the talisman, and his son, with a solemn face somewhat marred by a wink at his mother, sat down at the piano and struck a few impressive chords.
I wish for £200, said the old man distinctly.
A fine crash from the piano greeted the words, interrupted by a shuddering cry from the old man. His wife and son ran toward him.
It moved, he cried, with a glance of disgust at the object as it lay on the floor. As I wish, it twisted in my hand like a snake.
Well, I don't see the money, said his son, as he picked it up and placed it on the table, and I bet I never shall.
It must have been your fancy, father, said his wife, regarding him anxiously.
He shook his head.
Never mind, though. There's no harm done, but it gave me a shock all the same.
They sat down by the fire again, while the two men finished their pipes. Outside, the wind was higher than ever, and the old man started nervously at the sound of a door banging upstairs. A silence unusual and depressing settled upon all three, which lasted until the old couple rose to retire for the night.
I expect you'll find the cash tied up in a big bag in the middle of your bed, said Herbert, as he bade them good night.
And something horrible, squatting up on top of the wardrobe, watching you as you pocket your ill-gotten gains.
He sat alone in the darkness, gazing at the dying fire, and seeing faces in it. The last face was so horrible and so simian that he gazed at it in amazement. It got so vivid that, with a little uneasy laugh, he felt the table for a glass, containing a little water to throw over it. His hand grasped the monkey's paw, and with a little shiver, he wiped his hand on his coat and went up to bed. Part 2. In the brightness of the wintry sun next morning as it streamed over the breakfast table, Herbert laughed at his fears. There was an air of prosaic wholesomeness about the room, which it lacked on the previous night, and the dirty, shriveled little paw was pitched on the sideboard with a carelessness which betokened no great belief in its virtues.
I suppose all old soldiers are the same, said Mrs. White.
The idea of our listening to such nonsense! How could wishes be granted in these days? And if they could, how could £200 hurt you, father?
Might drop on his head from the sky, said the frivolous Herbert.
Morris said that things happened so naturally, said his father, that you might, if you so wished, attribute it to coincidence.
Well, don't break into the money before I come back, said Herbert, as he rose from the table. I'm afraid it'll turn you into a mean, avaricious man, and we shall have to disown you.
His mother laughed, and following him to the door, watched him down the road, and returning to the breakfast table, was very happy at the expense of her husband's credulity, all of which did not prevent her from scurrying to the door at the postman's knock, nor prevent her from referring somewhat shortly to retired sergeant majors of bibulous habits when she found that the post brought a tailor's bill.
Herbert will have some more of his funny remarks, I expect, when he comes home, she said, as they sat at dinner.
I dare say, said Mr. White, pouring himself out some beer. But for all that, the thing moved in my hand, that I'll swear to.
You thought it did, said the old lady soothingly.
I say it did, replied the other. There was no thought about it. I had just...
What's the matter?
His wife made no reply. She was watching the mysterious movements of a man outside, who, peering in an undecided fashion at the house, appeared to be trying to make up his mind to enter. In mental connection with the £200, she noticed that the stranger was well-dressed and wore a silk hat of glossy newness. Three times he paused at the gate and then walked on again. The fourth time, he stood with his hand upon it, and then, with sudden resolution, flung it open and walked up the path. Mrs. White, at the same moment, placed her hands behind her and, hurriedly unfastening the strings of her apron, put that useful article of apparel beneath the cushion of her chair. She brought the stranger, who seemed ill at ease, into the room. He gazed furtively at Mrs. White and listened in a preoccupied fashion as the old lady apologized for the appearance of the room and her husband's coat, a garment which he usually reserved for the garden. She then waited patiently for him to broach his business, but he was, at first, strangely silent. "I was asked to call," he said at last, and stooped and picked a piece of cotton from his trousers. "I came from Maw and Megan's." The old lady started.
"Is anything the matter?" she asked breathlessly. "Has anything happened to Herbert? What is it? What is it?"
Her husband interposed. "There, there, mother," he said hastily. "Sit down and don't jump to conclusions. You've not brought bad news, I'm sure, sir." And he eyed the other wistfully.
"I'm sorry," began the visitor. "Is he hurt?" demanded the mother wildly. The visitor bowed in assent.
"Badly hurt," he said quietly. "But he is not in any pain."
"Oh, thank God," said the old woman, clasping her hands. "Thank God for that.
She broke off suddenly, as the sinister meaning of the assurance dawned upon her, and she saw the awful confirmation of her fears in the other's averted face. She caught her breath, and turning to her husband, laid her trembling old hand upon his. There was a long silence.
"He was caught in the machinery," said the visitor at length in a low voice.
"Caught in the machinery," repeated Mr. White in a dazed fashion. "Yes." He sat staring blankly out at the window, and taking his wife's hand between his own, pressed it, as he had been wont to do in their old courting days nearly 40 years before.
"He was the only one left to us,"
he said, turning gently to the visitor.
"It is hard."
The other coughed, and rising, walked slowly to the window. "The firm wish me to convey their sincere sympathy with you in your great loss," he said, without looking around. "I beg that you will understand I am only their servant and merely obeying orders." There was no reply. The old woman's face was white, her eyes staring, and her breath inaudible. On the husband's face was a look such as his friend the sergeant major might have carried into his first action.
"I was to say that Maw and Megan's disclaim all responsibility," continued the other. "They admit no liability at all, but in consideration of your son's services, they wish to present you with a certain sum as compensation."
Mr. White dropped his wife's hand, and, rising to his feet, gazed with a look of horror at his visitor. His dry lips shaped the words, "How much?"
£200, was the answer.
Unconscious of his wife's shriek, the old man smiled faintly, put out his hands like a sightless man, and dropped, a senseless heap, to the floor. Part 3. In the huge new cemetery, some 2 miles distant, the old people buried their dead and came back to a house steeped in shadow and silence. It was all over so quickly that at first they could hardly realize it, and remained in a state of expectation as though of something else to happen, something else which was to lighten this load, too heavy for old hearts to bear. But the days passed, and expectation gave place to resignation, the hopeless resignation of the old, sometimes miscalled apathy. Sometimes they hardly exchanged a word, for now they had nothing to talk about, and their days were long to weariness. It was about a week after that, that the old man, waking suddenly in the night, stretched out his hand and found himself alone. The room was in darkness, and the sound of subdued weeping came from the window. He raised himself in bed and listened.
"Come back," he said tenderly. "You will be cold."
"It is colder for my son," said the old woman, and wept afresh. The sound of her sobs died away on his ears. The bed was warm, and his eyes heavy with sleep. He dozed fitfully, and then slept until a sudden wild cry from his wife woke him with a start.
"The paw!" she cried wildly. "The monkey's paw!"
He started up in alarm. Where is it? What's the matter?" She came stumbling across the room toward him.
"I want it," she said quietly. "You've not destroyed it."
"It's in the parlor, on the bracket," he replied, marveling.
"Why?" She cried and laughed together, and bending over, kissed his cheek. "I only just thought of it," she said hysterically. "Why didn't I think of it before? Why didn't you think of it?"
"Think of what?" he questioned.
"The other two wishes," she replied rapidly. "We've only had one."
"Was that not enough?" he demanded fiercely.
"No," she cried triumphantly.
"We'll have one more. Go down and get it quickly, and wish our boy alive again."
The man sat up in the bed and flung the bedclothes from his quaking limbs.
"You are mad," he cried aghast.
"Get it," she panted. "Get it quickly and wish. Oh, my boy, my boy."
Her husband struck a match and lit the candle.
"Get back to bed," he said unsteadily. "You don't know what you are saying."
"We had the first wish granted," said the old woman feverishly, "and why not the second?"
"A coincidence," stammered the old man.
"Go and get it and wish," cried his wife, quivering with excitement.
The old man turned and regarded her, and his voice shook.
"He has been dead 10 days. And besides, I would not tell you else, but I could only recognize him by his clothing. If he was too terrible for you to see, then how now?"
"Bring him back. Bring him back," cried the old woman, and dragged him toward the door.
"Do you think I fear the child I have nursed?"
He went down in the darkness and felt his way to the parlor, and then to the mantelpiece. The talisman was in its place, and a horrible fear that the unspoken wish might bring his mutilated son before him ere he could escape from the room seized upon him, and he caught his breath as he found that he had lost the direction of the door. His brow cold with sweat, he felt his way around the table and groped along the wall until he found himself in the small passage with the unwholesome thing in his hand. Even his wife's face seemed changed as he entered the room. It was white and expectant, and to his fears seemed to have an unnatural look upon it. He was afraid of her.
"Wish," she cried in a strong voice.
"It is foolish and wicked," he faltered.
"Wish," repeated his wife.
He raised his hand. "I wish my son alive again." The talisman fell to the floor, and he regarded it shudderingly. Then he sank, trembling, into a chair as the old woman with burning eyes walked to the window and raised the blind. He sat until he was chilled with the cold, glancing occasionally at the figure of the old woman peering through the window. The candle end, which had burned below the rim of the china candlestick, was throwing pulsating shadows on the ceiling and walls, until, with a flicker larger than the rest, it expired. The old man, with an unspeakable sense of relief at the failure of the talisman, crept back to his bed, and a minute or two afterward, the old woman came silently and apathetically beside him. Neither spoke, but both lay silently, listening to the ticking of the clock. A stair creaked, and a squeaky mouse scurried noisily through the wall. The darkness was oppressive, and after lying for some time screwing up his courage, he took a box of matches and, striking one, went downstairs for a candle. At the foot of the stairs the match went out, and he paused to strike another, and at the same moment a knock, so quiet and stealthy as to be scarcely audible, sounded on the front door. The matches fell from his hand and spilled in the passage. He stood motionless, his breath suspended until the knock was repeated. Then he turned and fled swiftly to his room and closed the door behind him. A third knock sounded through the house.
"What's that?" cried the old woman, starting up.
"A rat," said the old man, in shaking tones. "A rat. It passed me on the stairs." His wife sat up in bed, listening. A loud knock resounded through the house.
"It's Herbert," she screamed. "It's Herbert."
She ran to the door, but her husband was before her, and catching her by the arm, held her tightly.
"What are you going to do?" he whispered hoarsely. "It's my boy, it's Herbert," she cried, struggling mechanically. "I forgot it was 2 miles away. What are you holding me for? Let go. I must open the door."
"Don't let it in," cried the old man, trembling. "You're afraid of your own son?" she cried, struggling. "Let me go. I'm coming, Herbert. I'm coming."
There was another knock, and another. The old woman, with a sudden wrench, broke free and ran from the room. Her husband followed to the landing and called after her appealingly as she hurried downstairs. He heard the chain rattle back and the bottom bolt drawn slowly and stiffly from the socket. Then the old woman's voice, strained and panting.
"The bolt," she cried loudly. "Come down, I can't reach it."
But her husband was on his hands and knees, groping wildly on the floor in search of the paw. If he could only find it before the thing outside got in. A perfect fusillade of knocks reverberated through the house, and he heard the scraping of his chair as his wife put it down in the passage against the door. He heard the creaking of the bolt as it came slowly back, and at the same moment he found the monkey's paw and frantically breathed his third and last wish. The knocking ceased suddenly, although the echoes of it were still in the house. He heard the chair drawn back and the door opened. A cold wind rushed up the staircase, and a loud long wail of disappointment and misery from his wife gave him courage to run down to her side and then to the gate beyond. The street lamp flickering opposite shone on a quiet and deserted road.
And that was The Monkey's Paw by William Wymark Jacobs. Jacobs was the son of a wharf supervisor. He went on to be a bank employee and a postal worker before turning to writing full time. And the memories of the sailors and dock workers of his youth inspired the sea stories that Jacobs became famous for ultimately. He also wrote several humorous stories and horror tales, and obviously The Monkey's Paw, which is the one you just heard, is the best known of his tales, and very much in that gothic horror tradition. The story itself appeared in the collection called The Lady of the Barge, which was published in 1902, and Wymark Jacobs himself lived from 1863 to 1943. So this story appearing when he was still shy of 40 years of age, it's a really good one, isn't it? There's so much to pull apart. Again, I'm on my own for this one, so I'm going to keep it very brief. Neil's back for the next one, so we'll have more in-depth discussion because I know that part of the show is important to a lot of you. So just for those of you who do like that, I wanted to touch on a few of the things that I would have spoken about had Neil been with me and just maybe take you through a few of the things and, you know, reiterate some of the things that you would pick up on yourself and have picked up on as you were listening. And there's some very interesting stuff right from the start. I mean, you have the little warning that comes at the start of the story. People should be careful what they wish for. And that very much is the setting the tone for one of the key concepts of the story, which is, of course, this idea of wishing. Now, inextricably linked to magic. And the concept thereof, of magic, of the occult, of the idea of intention. Now, the talisman for that magic is, of course, the monkey's paw, which is sort of the type of gruesome artifact that you would associate with great, hair-raising stories of the past. And as I said, suitably gruesome in terms of it just being, you know, a dismembered body part of an animal, the kind of rabbit's foot thing, but with a more sinister overtone for sure. And when we have our character, Sergeant Major Morris, the family friend of the whites who served in India in the British Army, and he returns with his tales of, oh, you know, the magicians and the holy men and the horrifying experiences that he endured. He's so world weary that he could almost be, and the family, I think, initially dismiss him as, you know, a bit of a drunken soldier with his tales. And yet the story emphasizes the fact that when he speaks as well, especially with great morbidity or great seriousness, that his words carry weight with them. And they take seriously in a way that they can't even admit to themselves. They feel foolish admitting to themselves. And as he, when he's gone, they kind of make little jests about it. You know, you should wish yourself an emperor, Dad, says Herbert, and no one can boss you around. And, you know, they get to the point of wishing for the money. And
Herbert makes this little joke about how, you know, you'd probably get up there, the money would be in a bag, but there'll be something awful staring down at you with these simian features from the top of the wardrobe. And this, of course, again, is prefiguring and foreshadowing the type of horror that is to come. Now, there's a central thing here that I want to talk about, which is the role that magic plays in this story. And I've done a lot of reading about magic and just actually the power of intention. And it may interest you to know that there's quite a heavy, heavy crossover for those of you who are even more, who are more scientifically minded, between the concept of what is magic. I mean, you know, there's that line about, you know, anything that's sufficiently advanced enough will look like magic to someone who is unfamiliar with it. However, there's also this idea of the role of magic and the idea of the power of intention. And of course, that crosses over beautifully in enough of the stuff that I've been reading recently with quantum physics and things like the double slit experiment and things like the observer effect. So magic is what you make it, but it seems to be in this story inextricably linked and bound up to evil. So I just want to lay that out on the table here, because this is clearly a story that's a cautionary tale. You know, be careful what you wish for. We are told several times that the author is very clever. He lets us know about how happy these three people are in their little family unit. The son and mother take the mickey out of the father a little bit, but they're all happy and content. And in fact, White wonders at one point, what could I possibly wish for with this thing? I have all I need. I have all I want. But pushed to it, the natural greed that's in all of us comes out, and they decide to experiment with this talisman, as they call it, and to take a chance. And of course, the consequences as they play out are breathtakingly horrific. And you know, the last, because it's written in such an understated way, I think the language is so far from hysterical, the way the information is presented is quite matter of fact. It's not over the top. There's not a stress placed on hysteria. You might hear that his voice was shaky, or his voice was croaky, or she seemed, you know, a little bit overwrought or whatever, but there's nothing overly dramatic about it. And yet we see this cozy domestic unit falling apart because they become entangled with this thing that they knew better than to get entangled with. And the understated darkness of the end, where the reality is, no, it's not said, not really overtly said, it's hinted at, but the reality is that we have some sort of reanimated Herbert knocking on the door in response to the power of this monkey's paw talisman. He has been brought back to life. And of course, Mr. White thinks that this is an abomination. This is not his son. This is a creature 10 days dead, as I say, reanimated. Mrs. White takes a different view. Mrs. White thinks, if I can have any interaction with my son, then that's what I want, even if it's not what, you know, she knew as her son. She says, you think I'm going to be afraid of my son? And the point is that she's willing to make whatever leap is necessary to reconnect with her child. Mr. White is more fearful. Mr. White thinks, as I say, such a thing is an abomination. Such a thing is genuinely evil, and not to be invited into the home. And so you have the two of them working against each other, really. Mrs. White wishing for what Mr. White doesn't want. Mr. White making the decision at the end which denies Mrs. White of the thing that she wanted. And it's so sad, because these people were happy. This trio, this family unit, they were happy in themselves. They had a good life. And, you know, as our friend Sergeant Major Morris says, I warn you of the consequences. He was implying that wishes are almost always accompanied by a punishment for tampering with fate. And again, that's another sort of motif of this story, is the concept of fate, the concept of tinkering with fate. And of course, so many great stories have been about that very, very thing, the idea of tinkering with fate. Can you do it? Or are we all fated to have a certain destiny? Y. Mark Jacobs here plays with that concept beautifully. And he shows us the peril more than anything else. He shows us the peril of engaging with magic. He tells us by the end of this story that it is a darkness not to be messed with. And his somewhat overwrought, somewhat, you know, dismissed, ham character of Sergeant Major Morris turns out to be an absolutely truthful harbinger, prophet of what was to come. And his reluctance to pass it on to his friend, you'd like to think, might have been a bit more determined, especially as he tells us that the third wish of the previous owner was for death. That surely also should have been enough for Mr. and Mrs. and Junior White to very much think again, you'd have thought. So yeah, you look at it, the main idea is that idea of the danger of wishing, the danger of magic, the danger of tempting fate, that's absolutely there. There's a lovely little clash between cozy domesticity and the dangers that lie without the walls of the home. You know, you get the feeling that everything is safe and secure, and then they invite in this character. This character brings with him this talisman which is connected to some dark power. And from then, the cozy family domesticity is gone. The copper kettle, the games of chess, the knowing looks and winks and nods to each other. The unit, the happiness, the content that White admits that he had. That's all gone. That's ended. That's out the window. And there are other motifs as well. I mean, as you were listening to it, you couldn't have but be aware of the idea of groups of three, which is, of course, three is the magic number, right? As the song says, and again, any studies, even cursory studies into magic or the occult or anything like that will have you coming across discussions about the centrality of the idea of the number three or 33 or 333. It also, of course, has biblical significance, the number three too. And Jacob's story is sort of structured around this pattern of threes. The central kind of driving force of the story is the monkey's paw. This monkey's paw will grant three separate owners three wishes each. The White family itself is made up of three people. Mr. White, the third owner of the paw, the second owner, Sergeant Major Morris, the first, I think I'm contradicting myself here, was the guy who used his third wish for death. Sergeant Major Morris has had his three wishes as well. And he begins by talking about all his adventures in India after three glasses of whiskey. And when he warns Mr. White about the dangers of the paw and wishing on the paw, he does that three times. The guy representing Maw and Megan's, the firm for which Herbert works, he approaches the White's gate three times before he manages to gird himself to come to the door. Mrs. White orders her husband three separate times to wish Herbert alive before he retrieves the paw. And reanimated Herbie knocks three times before his mother finally hears him. The first two scaring the absolute living bejesus out of Mr. White. So apart altogether from the fact that it's interwoven and penetrates the plot, this number three also gives the story, the monkey's paw, its structure. It's broken into three parts, which take place at three times of the day during three different types of weather. Part one in the evening in a rainstorm, part two is in the morning on a lovely bright winter day, and part three is a chilly, windy night. And of course, we're reminded by the constant emphasis, whether we are even noticing it objectively, whether it's happening subconsciously, as we read this, we're reminded of concepts that we grew up with. The idea of, you know, bad luck comes in threes. and as I said, the number three has biblical significance, and you've got the Trinity. And if you disregard or disrespect that holy Trinity, and the idea is that ill fate will await you. And of course, we have to make the assumption that the Whites are Christian, some variety, and placing their faith in this pagan token, this monkey's paw, could obviously be interpreted as going contrary to their holy Trinity or showing disrespect for their faith. And then the last thing I wanted to talk about, just again, to give just a reference to some of the things I would have spoken about. I mean, if Neil had been here, one of the questions I'd have been asking him was, what would you have done in the White situation? You know, do you lean into the fire and grab it back? And then when your pal is gone, do you use that thing? And of course, that brings us down that really interesting road. And on a future podcast, I will tease it out with Neil, because it's going to be a recurring theme. This idea of how far does one dabble in what is deemed to be magic? And where is that crossover between, like I said earlier on, what people consider to be magic, or simply the power of intention, or simply a way in which our understanding of consciousness is changed by furtherments in our understanding of quantum physics? So it's a fascinating issue, but I'll finish by talking about two of the symbols, which are obviously very strong. The key one itself is the monkey's paw. It's a symbol of desire, greed, but also a sort of an exotic evil, an exotic occult, unknowable force. Something that comes, as I said earlier on, from the outside to within the cozy domesticity of the White household. It has a power to it, which is played up very dramatically by the Sergeant Major. And that power of the totem, of the token, of the talisman, makes the paw incredibly alluring. And we've had many million movies draw on this. Think of your Indiana Jones movies as they stare at something that is incredibly desirous. Think of your Lord of the Rings movies as we see what happens to Gollum with his obsession with the ring. And even then you can see someone who is pretty unassuming, someone who appears to be a decent man, an unselfish man, a man who has the power to maybe laugh at himself and see that he can be a bit vainglorious or a bit prideful or a bit hysterical or whatever it happens to be, like Mr. White. And we see this is well established in the opening scene where we see the family dynamic. Even a man like that is tempted to use and extract the power that is inherent in the paw. And when he retrieves the paw from the fire, even that itself is symbolic, I'd have thought. He tells us, like I said earlier, that he doesn't really know what he would wish for. He's content. He has everything he needs. But the potential brings out in Herbert the suggestion that, you know, just maybe try to wish for the money. It would be nice maybe to be debt-free, clear the house. And that is the gateway to hell. And that's what happens. And of course, it's a sequence of events. You can't blame any one of the characters. But the paw gives Mr. White's, grants him the wishes. It kills Herbert, but it also raises his corp later on, and it provides the money that they needed. So it's this incredibly sinister, twisted version of reality, of the wished for concept. But again, there is a way of reading this story, and I think those who are enthralled to scientism and the material realists out there, as they would see themselves, they will say, and there's a way, because again, White tells us that Sergeant Major Morris has said this, there's a way of reading the story where you go, look, everything that happened there is a coincidence. You know, that there's no malevolent evil force really there at all, because nothing was actually, can be actually proven. And that's the cleverness of it. That's the cleverness of the story, that it does work on one way, where if you are this materialist scientist type, you can read it and go, yeah, it's all coincidence. You know, we are all just robots in a meaningless universe. And so be it. I think it's wonderful that it can work that way too. The last thing that I want to mention then is the symbolism around the chess game. The chess is really subtle. The chess symbolizes life in the story. If you play in a daring, sort of risky way, you're likely to lose. Just like people who take unnecessary risks in life are likely to meet a nasty fate. Now, at the beginning of the story, we have Mr. White and his son playing chess, and the outcome of the game sort of mirrors the story's outcome. Mr. White, we're told, has a theory about radical changes concerning chess. He takes these terrible, unnecessary risks with his king, risks that make even his wife nervous as she watches, as she's knitting away. As he plays, he notices that he's made a mistake, a fatal error, because of his risky strategy. It's going to prove deadly. The risks and the mistakes that he makes playing chess, well, they parallel the risks and mistakes that he makes wishing on the monkey's paw, tempting fate, dabbling in the darkness of this talisman. The mistakes lead to Herbert's death, which is, of course, about as radical a change, to go back to that phrase, as one can imagine. I enjoyed reading this immensely. I enjoyed talking about it, even if I am talking to myself immensely. There's synapses are firing here as I'm talking. There's about 17 different ways I'd like to take it. Hopefully it wasn't too coherent of a ramble there for you. Can I ask that you let people know about the show? Can I ask that if it's within your power at all, you sign up as a subscriber producer on greatstoriespod.com? Get yourself access to all the goodies there. Animal Farm was what won the poll for the novel to be serialized first. This will be what will be happening. And if I can grow the show to a size where I can do it far more regularly and maybe take a step back from my day job, well, look out, because novels are going to be coming at you left and right. Chapter 1 will be there for members from Monday of Animal Farm by George Orwell. And similarly, as you know, because you've downloaded it, this episode is episode 30 of the show, a show I'm very proud of. Any support you can give at all, whether financial or otherwise, is massively appreciated. Neil's back for another belter of a story with me on Thursday. We're going to record that. So they're coming at you thick and fast as promised. And I've decided to go with that one with Neil instead of the bonus one that I've already recorded. That's in the bag in case we have another down time or a computer blows up or something like that that's ready to go. So enjoy if you are a subscriber. God bless you, by the way. If you are a subscriber, enjoy the bonus content. If you're not, please enjoy this episode and keep an eye out for episode 31. That will be coming faster than you.